السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Learned ulema, beloved brothers in Islam, I have listened with interest to Mufti Desai Sahib as well as Maulana Vankar Sahib address you on aspects. You might be aware that Maulana Muhammad Vankar Sahib is a product of this institution. He is an erstwhile student of Mufti Desai Sahib. And it comes with much joy and pleasure to see such beautiful product produced by this institution. Proof of the pudding is in the eating. Maulana Muhammad Vankar spoke very, very strongly about riba. Now, from a businessman's perspective, one would wonder, what does one do with one's funds? What does one do with the capital? Is it not perhaps the best option to invest, have others work for you, generate interest, and that is your income on your capital? Now, you see, my dear brothers, that is a fallacious argument for one reason. Those who collect your money from you through investments which you make with them, banks, other corporations, take those funds and themselves lend funds out to other people at high rates of interest. They are utilizing your money in order to generate interest income and sharing only part of those funds with you. If you were to utilize those funds yourself, your profits will be substantially higher, therefore the zakat which you pay will be substantially higher, and you will therefore empower the Muslim Ummah. We have such funds, such phenomenal amount of funds in the Ummah itself, and I'm not restricting myself to a national level. I think of an international level, that we can establish our own institutions, our own corporations, our own completely Sharia-compliant banks, and benefit all. Mufti Ibrahim Desai Sahib made reference to also a most interesting aspect relating to conventional medical aid. Now, the thought that crossed my mind is, there are probably many business persons present here who are employers, and who've already offered packages to members of their staff, which includes pension, which is interest-based, and medical aid benefits, which is also interest-based. Now, the question that must be going through their minds is, we've heard the principle, it is not Sharia-compliant, how do we deal with this problem? Because we've now already concluded contracts with our employees, which we're bound to comply with. And if our corporation continues operating for a long period of time, which we hope it does, we hope that our corporation continues long after our demise, then that means a product which we've introduced is something we're going to be answerable for in the hereafter. How do we now deal with it? Well, let me provide you with a solution for this. As you will find, there's a solution for all other problems relating to pension fund schemes, etc. One can now conclude an agreement with your employee. Call your employee. Explain to your employee why it is that the system pertaining to the medical aid benefits is non-Sharia compliant, whether your employee is a Muslim or not, and offer an alternative. I will increase your salary to the extent of the contributions which I am making on your behalf to the medical aid fund, and you take care of your own medical requirements. Now, the majority of your employees will probably find that very palatable, and you can then conclude a new employment agreement. Essentially, what you have with your employee is an employment contract or agreement. You can vary that consensually with the consent of your employee, and now have an employment agreement which is Sharia compliant. The same would apply to pension. Generally, the employer contributes twice that which the employee contributes. this goes to some administrator that's administrating your pension scheme or fund, which is interest-based, because those monies are now invested in industry, invested in various institutions, which provide income based on interest. There again, one can conclude a similar agreement. This can be structured properly by your chartered accountant or by your attorneys. These were ideas and thoughts which came to my mind as I sat there and listened to the two previous speakers, and I thought I should address it before I proceed with aspects which I had intended dealing with you. Now, you've probably heard, or some of you might not have heard, and I must therefore tell you about this quest, this search which people went, which people conducted for a lawyer with one hand. This person looked far and wide for this lawyer with only one hand. And I asked this person, now why do you want a lawyer with only one hand? Don't you think a lawyer with two hands is more adequately equipped, would be able to carry more books to court for you, etc., etc., would be able to write perhaps more voluminously? He says, no. You know, whenever I go to a lawyer with two hands and I put a question to him, he tells me, on the one hand, this is the solution, but on the other hand, this is the problem. I want a lawyer with one hand who will tell me what the position is. Now, we all know our beloved Prophet Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam said, go as far as China to acquire knowledge in quest of knowledge. Now, we have all come to Kampadan, so we're doing well, my brothers. I have found repeatedly the problem of people not reducing agreements to writing. I'm sure all of us seated here would have had agreements, concluded agreements of some type or the other, without having executed it in writing. We conclude agreements on a daily basis. Of course, it's not practically possible to reduce all agreements to writing. For example, you might have purchased a loaf of bread this morning. That's an agreement. What are the elements of an agreement? The first, and this is very important, it applies to everyone. You might have an agreement which you conclude, and you would decide you have to go to an attorney for advice. You don't necessarily need to go to attorneys or advocates for advice in relation to all matters. There are many matters in which my opinion sought, where the matter could easily and comfortably have been decided by the client himself, if he simply sat down and thought about it. And I'm going to show you, as simply as possible, certain basic principles which you can apply in your day-to-day negotiations and transactions, which will assist you in reducing legal costs, costs of seeking advice from accountants, but most important of all, comply with Sharia requirements. Now, reducing your agreements to writing is an injunction in the Holy Quran and Majid. So it is something which we have to do. Now, when you purchase a loaf of bread, you're essentially making an offer. If you know the price of the loaf of bread, what you do is, you go with the loaf of bread to the counter, you place the loaf of bread on the counter, and you place the money next to the loaf of bread. What you're essentially saying is, I want to purchase this loaf of bread, and the offer which I'm making to you is in this particular amount. The storekeeper, by receiving your money and putting it into his till and giving you the loaf of bread or putting it into a packet for you, is saying, I accept your offer. The thing which has been sold is, in law, given a fancy term, and this is what introduces the confusion. It's called the merks, M-E-R-X. In this case, it's simply a loaf of bread. So we've agreed what is going to be purchased and sold, a loaf of bread. And the price you've paid, again, the law gives a fancy term to, it's called the pretium, P-R-E-T-I-U-M, but it simply means the price. Here you have an agreement which you've just concluded. Now, that is a simple form of agreement. Many of us would have gone into the petrol station this morning and filled petrol. You've concluded an agreement with the agents of the person who owns the petrol service station. The employees who you dealt with are his agents, and you concluded an agreement with him. Now, assuming you drove away from that petrol station and you found your car stalled and you rushed over to, or you summoned a mechanic who came along, took your car away and did certain tests and said, look, what was put into your car was partially petrol but partially water. And you discover subsequently there was a leak in the tank where the petrol is stored and some water was pumped into your tank. Now, there has been a breach of that agreement by the owner of that service station. Now, the owner of the service station might tell you, but look, I didn't even meet you, I didn't even talk to you, you dealt with my employees. That does not assist him, because his employees were his agents. And you now are entitled to sue him for breach of contract flowing from the fact that he has not complied with the terms of your agreement. Now, what were the terms of your agreement? The terms of your agreement were that you are purchasing petrol from him. He is to supply you with petrol, not petrol diluted with water. Now, we know what the position in terms of Sharia is. You comply with your bargain. If you sell petrol, you deliver petrol. You don't deliver half petrol, half water. It's also expedient to use as simple language as possible. I'll give you an example. Someone told me once, a judge who is sitting now as a judge in the High Court, concluded an agreement relating to some property transaction. And he tells me, you know, that agreement was simply one page long. What kind of an agreement did this judge draw up? I'd much rather come to you, he tells me, because this judge draws up an agreement which is simply one page long. You draw a far better agreement with lots of clauses, etc., etc. Now, that's a misconception. One needs to be as simple as possible. You can easily conclude an agreement with the person whom you are contracting with. You simply set out all the terms which are applicable. If it is something you're purchasing, describe what it is you're purchasing. Describe the price. Describe the method of payment. Now, let me show you a comparison between Sharia and between South African law. And you then conclude which is the more superior of the two systems. And I'm going to give you one example. I promise you there are myriads of examples. There are many, many examples in this vein. Sharia says, provides, conclude all your agreements in writing. Injunction. Direction in the Holy Quran from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. South African law says certain agreements, if not concluded in writing, will be invalid. I'll give you an example. The sale of immovable property. If you sell your property, you can sell me your property now in the presence of the entire audience here. You can tell me, look, I sell you my land for 500,000 rands. It is my word, I sell it to you. And assuming I remove the money and I pay you 500,000 rands in the presence of all these witnesses now, and you then go away and you come back to me tomorrow and you tell me, look, I've changed my mind. I do not want to transfer this land to you. Please, I'm sending you the 500,000, accept it. Do you know I cannot enforce that agreement against you? It is an unenforceable agreement. It is an invalid agreement because it does not comply with South African law. In order for that agreement to have been valid, I ought to have reduced it to writing. South African law provides certain agreements have to be reduced to writing, not all agreements. I can sell you my car without reducing that to writing. Now look at the anomaly. Look at the contradiction. Why is it that certain agreements have to be reduced to writing and not other agreements? Because there's an act which says you have to reduce that agreement to writing. What is the rationale behind the act? What's the reason for the act? Well, because it usually involves large sums of money, it is good to reduce it to writing in case there's dispute between the parties. But we have motor vehicles which are also very expensive. Sometimes the cost of motor vehicles are higher than the cost of land. So you see the fallacy in the South African law, the misconception. Sharia says reduce all your agreements to writing. That's just one phenomena. While speaking to you, another thought comes to mind, and I might as well share this with you as well. Take the law of marriage, pertaining to breakdown of marriages. In terms of the South African law, some decades ago, in order for a plaintiff to succeed with a divorce action, he'd have to prove one of the following in a divorce court. He'd have to prove that either the defendant, who might be his wife, or if the plaintiff was the wife, then the defendant might be the husband, but the spouse has maliciously deserted him, or is in prison, or has gone insane, or has committed adultery. Those were one of the grounds for divorce. If you didn't have one of those, you couldn't get divorced in South African law. Then relatively recently, a few decades back, the South African law changed what was the fault principle to the breakdown principle. And what is a breakdown principle? Well, when the marriage has broken down irretrievably and the parties cannot reconcile, then the person is entitled to a divorce.